Attorneys Haskell and Schaefer, can you hear me? Okay, we're going to have a little demonstration by the Supreme Court's marshal about how we keep time when we're doing oral arguments on Zoom. And we're doing it by cards with colors and numbers on the cards. So when it's time for you to begin, you'll see a green card. It says start. When you have 5 minutes left to go, you'll see a yellow card. Says 5 minutes. And when it's time for you to conclude, you'll see a red card and it'll say stop. I will keep track of the red card for you. But if there is a question pending from a justice, you always may answer that question. If you're more comfortable asking me if you can continue, that's fine. But just so you know, I will always say yes. Are you ready to proceed, Attorney Haskell?
Yes.
Okay. Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. For 47 years, this court has held that substitution is permitted before the hearing of any preliminary contested matters. According to this court, the dispositive question when deciding whether something is a preliminary contested matter is whether it relates to the substantive issues in the case. Here, Mr. Matthews sought substitution before the court heard any contested matters implicating the merits of a Chapter 980 petition. The only matter that had been heard was a request to reschedule the probable cause hearing. Rescheduling a hearing is quintessentially procedural. It's not substantive. So Mr. Matthews is not asking this court to make any change in the law or to change any rule, simply to continue to apply the rule as this court has repeatedly affirmed it. To affirm the Court of Appeals and to adopt the state's reading would be to overrule that 47 years of precedent. Now, the preliminary contested hearing language is not a legislative creation. It's something that this court adopted first 47 years ago in Pure Milk in 1974. At the time, the legislative language on substitution was much broader, not necessarily ruling out the opportunity to substitute after the court had begun hearing matters. But this court in Pure Milk, you know, surveyed, I think, a number of other states and looked at what they were doing and saw that in most of these other jurisdictions, it was after the hearing of contested preliminary matters, they were shutting off the opportunity to substitute. And so this court then adopted that rule itself after, again, examining those other cases and held finally there that substitution was not permitted after the hearing of contested motion, which implicates the merits of the action. So that really is the beginning and the end of this case, because the only thing that has been heard in this matter was an adjournment. The parties had arrived to court prepared to argue probable cause, but before any witness said a word about probable cause, the defense had moved for an adjournment, which the prosecutor stated an objection for the record, but indicated that its only witness was not in fact present at the hearing anyway. And the court reluctantly granted the objection. So the court really had two separate questions that it had to resolve on the day of this hearing, the trial court. I mean, the first was when to have a probable cause hearing. And the second is whether there was probable cause to hold Mr. Matthews. This case only concerns the first of those questions and is the only question that the court actually reached was when to have that hearing. Again, a fundamentally procedural question. The court took no evidence, heard no argument, didn't do anything related to the substance of a Chapter 980 petition, which is what was required first.
Now, you didn't cite Kalal case in your briefing, nor did the state, and it's our seminal case outlining how this court is supposed to approach issues of statutory construction. And when I apply Kalal, I don't see in the statute any reference to the merits or the substance of the case. That does, as you note in the beginning of your argument, that exists in our cases. Is your analysis any different under the Kalal framework?
No, because I mean, I think the problem there is that the language of the statute itself, again, is taken from this court's precedents. It is a statement of the law as already adopted by this court that preliminary contested matters means only the substantive issues in the case. And I think that I've likened it to I mean, the Sixth Amendment protects a defendant's right to counsel, but it has been construed to mean the effective assistance of the right to counsel. The word effective, you know, is not within the Sixth Amendment, but was what was adopted with the Sixth Amendment. You know, similarly here, preliminary contested matters was the language that was adopted by this court in 1974 in Pure Milk. And in 1977, when the legislature changed its the substitution statute, it used the language borrowing it from Pure Milk, and with it took the meaning of Pure Milk. And that is what the cases subsequent to have also indicated, repeatedly noting that the intent of this statute is to prevent substitution following the court weighing in on the substantive matters in the case. I think stated most concisely by this court in Seelin, indicating that the dispositive question is whether the hearing concerned the substantive issue which went to the merits of the case.
But under the Kalau framework, we're not supposed to look at the intent of the legislature or the purpose of the statute, except to the extent that it's expressed in the actual text of the statute.
But doing so in this instance would require overruling 47 years of precedent and, I think, disregarding the reality that the legislature did adopt what was, again, a term of art when it was used, preliminary contested matters, rather than meaning simply a matter that is contested before the hearing, that from Pure Milk, this court has indicated, this means, again, something reaching the merits of the matter.
Another approach to the case that I think would still result in a favorable ruling for your client would be for this court to rule that there wasn't any preliminary contested matter at the hearing that was actually heard, because while the state lodged an objection to the motion for adjournment, it had already called off its witness, and so it really didn't advance any arguments at all to the trial court judge against the motion. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I do. As noted in briefing, the state's objection, again, was made for the record and appeared disingenuous at the time. The prosecutor had, as a courtesy, of course, told their witness not to bother coming, believing surely that the court was going to grant the adjournment because defense counsel's, you know, lack of preparedness for the hearing was going to prevent anybody from actually hearing probable cause. And so the prosecutor called off its witness. It's unclear why the prosecutor decided to object for the record. But yes, this was not a genuinely contested hearing in this particular case. That is correct.
So Mr. Haskell, just springboarding off of Justice Bradley's last question, if that motion for an adjournment had become contested, that is, if the state had objected and said, no, my witnesses are here, there's a victim in this case, and victims in the state have a right to have these cases dispensed with as quickly as possible, would that change your assessment? Do you believe then it would be a preliminary contested matter?
No, because as I indicated earlier, the issue is that there were two separate questions that were before the court. I mean, again, the first is simply when we're going to have the hearing. I mean, the court only resolved that. The court could have denied the request for an adjournment, and again, having no bearing on the merits of the matter. But at that point, the defense still had intact their right to substitute and could have sought substitution at that point. I acknowledge it. The statute requires that the request be in writing, and so the defense would have had to come prepared with a substitution request in writing, I think. But there's nothing that would have prevented the defense from then submitting their request to substitute after the court had denied the procedural motion to adjourn. And they would have, again, that right to substitution would have been intact at that point. Now, the court had...
Go ahead, Alan.
If the court had denied the adjournment, of course, and the defense had not moved to substitute at that point, and the hearing on probable cause had proceeded, you know, then we would have been in that second part of things, whether there was probable cause, which is a preliminary contested matter, I believe.
So, counsel, how much weight do we put on the part of the statute that talks about hearing of? It's interesting that it's not hearing on. So are we talking about just the hearing itself, whether or not it actually occurred?
Yeah.
Does it actually have to be heard, which is kind of what you're saying, is that it wasn't heard. The substance wasn't heard.
Correct. The substance actually has to be heard. And this is where I think that the parties are reading the statute somewhat differently, and that the state has advanced an argument that hearing It seems to be a noun, that it has to be before a hearing on probable cause. And again, the problem there is that we still have, in this case, have not had a hearing on probable cause at the time the defense has requested substitution. Again, we had what was scheduled to be a hearing on probable cause, but probable cause was never, in fact, heard by the court or argued by any of the parties. This was resolved on the motion to adjourn only, which, again, is a procedural matter. And so I do think that preceding the hearing of any preliminary contested matters requires that the court actually hear something related to the substantive matters in the court, not simply schedule a hearing. I think that Seeland case that the parties discuss a bit was the first time where this court had held that, you know, motions to compel discovery would be a preliminary contested matter. I think in the Seeland's case, if a completed hearing on the motion to compel discovery was a preliminary contested matter, but if they'd showed up to that preliminary contested matter and a party had indicated, I'm sorry, judge, you know, I was out of town for whatever reason and I need an adjournment, and it gets rescheduled, I don't think we can say that the court has heard a preliminary contested matter.
Again, yeah, I think you're interpreting hearing as something in the past tense. I think what Justice Dallet was focused on, or at least what I'm interested in, is the word hearing necessary to be interpreted in a past tense? Because the full statute requires the defendant file a written request for substitution before the hearing. So if you have to do it before the hearing and interpreting before as something obviously preceding, and your request was not filed before the hearing, so whether the hearing went forward or not, it depends on how you interpret the word hearing. You're interpreting it as heard, having heard a contested matter. But I think the state argues you have to file it once that hearing is, you have to file that before the hearing. And so you didn't file it before the hearing. That the hearing didn't go forward because of a request to adjournment is a little bit different statutory interpretation, right?
Well, I think we're not necessarily reading hearing as in the past tense, more reading it as a verb. The state is suggesting it has to be before the hearing, a noun, and we're saying before the court, before the hearing of, before the court hears issues on a substantive matter. And then the second, you know, I think, problem with that reading is that we adjourned the probable cause hearing in this case, and so there was still a preceding the hearing of any preliminary contested matters. I mean, there was the day before, or on the day of the rescheduled probable cause hearing was still preceding the hearing of any preliminary contested matters. When the defense filed their motion to substitute, it was still preceding the hearing on probable cause. The fact was simply that we rescheduled the hearing on probable cause. They did not file it preceding the first hearing that was supposed to decide probable cause, but they did file it before the second hearing, where it was still probable cause was a future event. It was not something that had actually been discussed by the parties yet.
Mr. Haskell, was that you, Justice Dallet? Go ahead. Oh, wait.
Sorry. Does it matter that it's hearing of? It's interesting that it's not hearing on. So a hearing on something could be something that's just scheduled, right? But hearing of, we're back to the whole verb noun, right? Hearing of, is it a hearing of the actual matter that has to take place? And do you see a difference between the of and the on, or is that not relevant to your argument?
I think that it's probably small. I don't know that it would matter to my particular argument, because again, we believe that there needs to have been the court actually hearing these matters. But I think hearing of does further suggest that this is meant, again, as a verb, that the court is hearing of the matter, rather than a hearing on the matter, rather than the hearing on probable cause, that the court has to hear of probable cause, that there needs to be something spoken about the substantive matter, something of those substantive matters that is heard by the court, be it argument, evidence. I mean, there is case law suggesting the court does not need to take evidence, and we're not suggesting that needed to happen. But the problem is that there was nothing that was done towards the advancement of probable or of hearing probable cause in this case before the defense timely sought substitution.
Mr. Haskell, if I'm understanding you, you're saying that a motion for an adjournment or having a hearing on an adjournment would never be a preliminary contested matter. So I'm wondering how this potentially could play out in real life if you had, say, an attorney who meant to file a substitution motion, but for one reason or another did not. That attorney could simply walk into court and, having failed to file the motion in time for substitution, could just ask for an adjournment. Right? I mean, it seems to then make the timelines regarding substitution meaningless.
I don't think that it makes the timelines for substitution meaningless. I mean, there is still the requirement that it be filed 60 days after the receipt of the summons and complaint. And in this case, again, there simply was plenty of time. And so there's still a, you know, timeliness requirement that needs to be met. Separately, you know, I think the practical issues are that, you know, this has been the rule for 47 years, and I don't know that we see any, you know, rash of or adjournments being sought simply to preserve the right to substitution. I don't think that there's any, you know, serious problem occurring with, you know, untimely substitutions being sought because it wasn't filed properly. I think that it's to, again, affirm the Court of Appeals is really the breaking with precedent in this case. I think that as long as the rules to substitution exist, yeah, there may be parties who seek to exploit those rules in one way or another. There's, you know, bits of gamesmanship the parties may try to engage in, but I don't think there's any indication that there's, you know, a problem with the court's current interpretation that, yeah, may allow a party to seek an adjournment in order to file a written request for substitution that was inadvertently not filed. But that doesn't really change, again, the longstanding precedent here that it be a substantive matter, that we not lose the right to substitution when the court only hears these collateral matters that don't have any bearing on the merits of the case. And that's where this case, you know, I think fortunately is really sort of a simple one and a straightforward one. I mean, there's not, you know, issue where the court had started to hear anything related to probable cause, or there's no concern that the court had, you know, begun to hear arguments from the party on anything that might bear on the merits of the matter. I think this one's pretty straightforward, that all that's happened is a rescheduling. And there's nothing else on the record that has occurred to suggest that the court is deciding the merits of the action or is hearing the substance of the case.
Well, there is the court's initial determination, obviously, that there is probable cause to proceed.
The court had made an ex parte finding, yes. Right. And in Pure Milk, again, this court had noted that there was no problem with the ex parte findings that the court had already made. And in Threlfall, which I believe is cited in my brief, you know, the Court of Appeals as well, it concluded that this ex parte finding does not have any bearing on a litigant's right to substitution, because that 60-day clock really starts when the defendant is actually served with the summons and complaint, or in the 980 context with that petition to commit the individual. And so there's no concern that has had any bearing on this case. And I believe the state has conceded as much in briefing that ex parte finding isn't a preliminary contested matter.
So, counsel, if the court had accepted the certified copy of the prior conviction showing a sexually violent offense, that would have commenced the hearing for purposes of the substitution request, correct? But here, the waiver of time limits itself is not enough in your mind to do that.
The waiver of time limits is not enough. Whether the court had decided to, you know, begin admitting evidence if the parties had stipulated to, you know, admit the exhibits that they knew would be admitted at the probable cause hearing, maybe that gets us a little further. But again, that's where I'd come back to again. This one's a straightforward case. We don't have those difficult facts here before us. You know, if the court had done that, I could imagine that it wouldn't have been contested, probably, that the parties would have actually stipulated to the exhibits having been admitted. And so that may, you know, create a problem.
They're still contesting probable cause finding, correct?
I'm sorry, I lost the beginning of that.
They're still contesting whether there's probable cause. We have to look at the substance of what the hearing is about, right? Not just whether they're actually arguing over a piece of evidence at that moment.
Right. Right. But again, there being no argument about the evidence in this case, no argument about probable cause, only, again, the scheduling of a hearing, which is my concern still, is that the Court of Appeals and the lower court has sort of elevated what was supposed to happen at this hearing over what actually did happen. And that, again, the language of the statute contemplates, and this court's interpretation of that statute contemplates, the hearing of preliminary contested matters, the hearing of substantive matters by the court, not simply putting on a calendar, we're going to begin hearing substantive matters, but that the court actually hear something about them.
So if I understand what you're saying, then, if it's not contested, then someone could still file a substitution. So what if they had decided we're going to have the probable cause hearing and we're all going to stipulate that there's probable cause here? Are you saying that in that case, there would not have been a hearing on a preliminary contested matter because no one was contesting it?
No, I concede that I probably spoke out of turn there. I do actually think that, again, this court's precedent makes it pretty clear that the answer is whether the court has heard matters relating to the substantive issues in the case. Whether the parties have stipulated to it, I don't know, necessarily controls. Again, I don't want to wander too far down as well as hypotheticals in this case, because there's nothing complicated here. Again, this is a rescheduling of a matter that occurred before the court. This court does not need to go beyond what it is stated in Pure Milk and Seelan and all of these other cases that are cited in the parties' briefs to be able to, you know, overrule or reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. This court merely needs to affirm Seelan in order to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. Counsel,
your response to Justice Karofsky's question, though, suggests that we disregard the language of the statute and simply apply the statements that have been made by this court in our prior cases. But the statute itself says the written request shall be filed preceding the hearing of any preliminary contested matters. So, in fact, I mean, this is not what we're dealing with, I think, in this case. But if a matter, even if it were substantive, were heard by the court, but it was not contested, then this statute doesn't come into play, right?
I think that it probably doesn't matter which interpretation this court adopts. I think that, as you know, Justice Kelly, you and I were, or your questioning had led me down the path earlier, that sure, preliminary contested matters, if read under this Kalal framework, would require actually a contest of the issue, that the subject actually be contested, you know, maybe regardless of whether it's substantive or not, but that this court's prior case law requires that it be a substantive issue. I think that under either case, we have here something that neither goes to the substance of the issue nor was contested legitimately in the trial court. Everybody needed this adjournment because there were no witnesses prepared. So I don't think that it particularly matters whether the court tries to take that type of plain reading of the statute or adheres to its interpretation of the statute since Pure Milk.
Counsel, of what import is the language of Kalal in paragraph 45 that, and I'll paraphrase it for you, hopefully correctly, because I'm sure you don't have paragraph 45 of Kalal memorized. So in paraphrasing it, I'll say it's the plain language of the statute. And let me see if I have my notes. Except that there may be technical or specially defined words or phrases are given their technical or special meaning. Earlier, in response to a question, you indicated that a preliminary contested matter was a term of art taken from Pure Milk products. How does that this term of art fold into the discussion in paragraph 45 of Kalal regarding special meaning of phrases?
I mean, that would seem to suggest that, in fact, the phrase preliminary contested matter should be given the, you know, known meaning that it was given in Pure Milk, that, again, the legislature was, in fact, adopting a previously defined term from Pure Milk when writing that term into the statute. And so the phrase preliminary contested matter should be read to mean the same thing that it meant in Pure Milk, where, again, the court had surveyed all of these cases and concluded that it only barred substitution after the hearing of a contested motion implicating the merits of the action, going to the substantive. The court, you know, further going on to explain that collateral matters not bearing on that final decision, you know, really have nothing to do with a litigant's substitution right. And so in this case, this is only a collateral matter that's been heard. It's only this procedural decision to reschedule. And I think that this case really does come down to adhering to that precedent from Pure Milk and from Seelin on that court's adoption of the, or in the legislature's adoption of the term preliminary contested matters, or overruling all of that and holding that a rescheduling is somehow now a preliminary contested matter. And again, I think that this court's precedents leave no mistake that the court needs to reach a substantive issue in a case before it can be said to have heard a preliminary contested matter.
Counsel, I note from the briefing that you both agree that the state did lodge an objection to the adjournment. I know the state's witness wasn't there, but that was explained by counsel that he had told the witness not to appear because the counsel for the state was aware that you were not going to be prepared to go, not you, but the defendant was not going to be prepared to go forward at that time. But he still objected on the record. Does that objection play any part of our determination about whether this matter, procedural or substantive, was contested?
No, I don't think so. I think the problem with the state's objection is that it would require this court to, I guess, ignore that it was a disingenuous objection. I mean, I thought it was a courteous
response to the counsel for Mr. Matthews, who was very candid about saying he just hadn't been able to get ready for this hearing. And so the state did file an objection. And does their filing of the objection, I don't think it was disingenuous, but does it preserve any interest of the state to argue then that a later substitution request is too late?
No, I don't think it does, because again, they've objected only to this procedural matter about an adjournment and not any sort of substantive issue that's to be decided in the case. I mean, as noted in briefing, if the court had denied the adjournment and said, all right, no, we're going to go forward with probable cause hearing today, the state would have been required to join in the request for an adjournment, or the case would have been dismissed as the consequence in Chapter 980. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your answer. Attorney Schaefer, are you ready to begin?
I am.
Please do.
May it please the court, Mr. Haspel, Assistant Attorney General Sarah Schaefer, representing the state in this appeal, the respondent. Your Honors, it is the state's position that Mr. Matthews' request for judicial substitution was untimely under 801.581. And that is because under the statute, Mr. Matthews was required to file his substitution request preceding the hearing of any preliminary contested matter. Now, it is undisputed that a probable cause hearing is a preliminary contested matter. And it is also undisputed that he failed to file his substitution request preceding the probable cause hearing. And for these reasons, the state's main argument on appeal is that his substitution request was untimely.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals held, at least as I read it, and feel free to correct me if you read it differently, but the Court of Appeals said the plain language of the statute does not require a trial court ruling on a substantive issue, and then later said that the trial court heard a contested motion to adjourn the probable cause proceeding. And as I understood the Court of Appeals, I felt like it was saying that anything that's contested is a preliminary contested matter and could satisfy the statute. And I read your brief to disagree with the Court of Appeals rationale. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether I read both of those accurately or not, and feel free to maybe explain your position on the Court of Appeals decision.
Sure. So the Court of Appeals decision, basically, the way they framed the decision was whether the adjournment was the preliminary contested matter. And my whole argument to the Court of Appeals and to this court was it's not the adjournment that's the preliminary contested matter, it's the probable cause hearing. I don't even think this court needs to get to whether the adjournment is a probable cause hearing, because one, we have the hearing is the probable cause hearing and he did not file it preceding the hearing. And two, even if this court disagrees with the state's interpretation, so the state does interpret the hearing as an event, as a noun. And that's where Mr. Haskell and I, Mr. Matthews and I differ. When I read the statute, when I see you must file it preceding the hearing, that's the event, that's the noun. If this court disagrees with that interpretation, and that's how the Court of Appeals interpreted it as hearing, the Court of Appeals and all the lower courts still held that even if you see the hearing as a noun, he still filed his substitution request untimely because it did not file the preliminary contested matter of, well, one, what everybody concedes is a contested matter is the extension of the 10-day probable cause hearing. And so I didn't argue the way that the Court of Appeals held it. I did argue it differently than the way they held it. I phrased it completely differently. So, and just to...
So before you go ahead, just building on your reasoning. So if there's a probable cause hearing date set, and let's say this adjournment happened off the record, which it oftentimes does, where the clerk will just call the parties and assign a new date. What's the hearing? Is the hearing the first hearing? Because that first hearing was scheduled for, let's say, a while, and then they assign a new date, and then that's the next. So what's the, under your reading, what's the hearing? What if it's adjourned three times and they do a waiver in writing of the time limits or whatever, and they never even come into court?
Right.
What would be the trigger? I think that's what I'm having a hard time with the way you're reading.
So again, the state's main argument is that, so the hearing was the first probable cause hearing that was only adjourned because of Mr. Matthews' actions. I'm getting an adjournment. Now, under Mr. Matthews' interpretation, that wasn't a preliminary contested matter because the court didn't reach a substantive issue. But under that interpretation, then there could be multiple appearances. There could be multiple adjournments. And as long as he brings a substitution request before the court reaches or rules a substantive issue, the court must grant a substitution.
Well, and isn't that in practice how it happens? I mean, I was in the circuit court and that's exactly how it happened. Before there was anything substantive, people could make that substitution request. Isn't that how our court had interpreted before, prior to the statute? Isn't that what Pure Milk and the other cases understood, is that it was not about just getting in front of the judge physically. It was about the judge actually making a decision on something substantive with the idea that a person is not then allowed to substitute because they don't like the way the judge ruled on something substantive. I mean, wasn't that the heart of what this all was about?
That is part of the background of 801.581. However, when you read the cases that subsequent to Pure Milk, like especially when you look at Tarney, and they say a reasonable interpretation of the statute is that is to give litigants a reasonable amount of time to file a judicial substitution request after they learn who the judge assigned is to the case. And so that's why in this case, he had a reasonable period of time to request judicial substitution. The record indicates that Mr. Matthews found out about the hearing on July 30th. He did not file a substitution request until August 29th. And I think if you look at the Tarney language and you also look at Galaxy Gaming and Sealand, they say, you know, you don't want parties to test the waters. And I think the legislative intent, I mean, that's exactly what happened here. We have 801.581 because they don't want litigants to test the waters. So under my reading of the hearing as a noun, it would completely prohibit litigants from testing the waters.
Well, how are the waters tested if the judge hasn't made any substantive decision or not? I mean, doesn't that go against what you're saying? Because So what? You know who the judge is. If they haven't actually decided anything against you, let's say, how are you testing anything?
Well, I think this case shows that it was, even though the court didn't reach whether there was probable cause, because when the motion for adjournment was made, she clearly scolded, you know, the attorney for the late adjournment request. And she went at length on how, you know, she had a free calendar and, you know, the family is here, everybody, the state's ready to go. And so I don't think in that case, I mean, he was testing the waters. The court did scold him. And so then 2 weeks later, he filed, a judicial substitution request before the second probable cause hearing.
But the judge actually ruled in his favor. So if he was really testing the waters, he got a favorable ruling. His adjournment request was granted.
His adjournment, yes, that is correct, but it didn't have to be. And that's where the language implicates merits of the case and whether it goes to the further presentation of the case happens. It doesn't, so whether it was contested or not doesn't matter how the court ruled. It's whether the rulings could have implicated the merits of the case. And in this case, had the court denied his motion to adjourn or denied his request for judicial, for the 10-day extension of the statutory deadline, then it would have implications on his case. It would have implications in a probable cause hearing. The court could have started the probable cause hearing with Mr. Matthews' counsel being unprepared. So I don't think, you know, whether, I mean, I don't think whether the court's, you know, as I stated in my brief, the court's displeasure with the adjournment had nothing to do with whether the substitution request was timely. And that is the main issue on appeal. And the state just contends that it wasn't timely because it wasn't filed preceding the probable cause hearing.
If a request for an adjournment implicates the merits, as I'm understanding your argument, what wouldn't?
So the state's argument isn't that the adjournment, I mean, I agree with the Court of Appeals decision that the adjournment in this case did implicate the merits of the case. But the state's argument on appeal is that one, you know, as I said before, the probable cause hearing, but it was also the contested extension of the 10-day statutory deadline. That was contested. That is not merely procedural. I mean, if the roles are reversed and the state came to the probable cause hearing and the defendant was prepared and the state said, okay, so the state's not prepared, we're going to move to extend the statutory deadline and we want to adjourn and it's granted. And the next time I bring a substitution motion and I argue, you know, the state's, you know, contested extension of the statutory deadline was merely procedural while the defendant has to wait in custody, I don't think that would fly with, you know, the defendant or the court. It's not merely a procedural issue. It's a substantive issue. I mean, under Mr. Matthews' argument, the only substantive issue is whether he is a sexually violent person. And I just think there's more substantive issues in this case. And one of them is whether the court could, under its discretion, grant the 10-day extensionary, 10-day statutory deadline.
Counsel, I'm having difficulty grasping that a motion to adjourn is a substantive issue. You indicate in your comments that it could have implications for the case, whether or not you indicate defense counsel is ready, you know, it could have implications, but could have implications for the case, I don't think is the same as substantive issues. So could you help me with that? Because I'm finding it difficult to see how a motion to adjourn addresses a substantive issue on the merits.
Sure. So in this case, the motion to adjourn, I mean, again, the main argument is, I don't think this court even has to get to the motion to adjourn. I think it can get to the, you know, probable cause hearing or the 10-day extension, which was contested. But the Court of Appeals did focus on the motion to adjourn. And I think the way they got to that language in implicating the merits is when they looked at the Sealing case, which is this court's most recent case discussing the substitution. And when they're discussing the party's arguments, they say the state argued specifically the estate. They contend that although no one testified at the motion to compel, which was the preliminary contested matter, the outcome of the motion could have directly affected the presentation of the case, and thus it was a preliminary contested matter. And then they go in the next paragraph to say a motion to compel discovery implicates the merits because of what the court could have found. So similarly in this case, if the court would have denied the motion to adjourn, the motion to extend, that implicates the merits of the case going further, because it implicates whether the probable cause hearing could go forward or had to go forward. And that implicates Mr. Matthews' right to have, you know, efficient counsel represent him at the probable cause hearing. And so that's where the Court of Appeals gets it implicates the merits of the case, is from this court's decision in Sealing. But as I said, I don't think this court needs to get to whether the adjournment is a preliminary contested matter, because I think we have two others. And if this court wants to determine this case narrowly, it can either go with the way the state interprets the statute, or it can go with the verb statute and determine that the extension, the contested extension of the 10-day statutory deadline was a preliminary contested matter. And as both the lower courts, the chief judge, and the trial court, that extension of the 10-day statutory time limit was a substantive issue. I think the Court of Appeals really had a hard time. They didn't want to state that the motion to adjourn was a substantive issue. But what the trial court, the chief judge did in this case is they said, you know, we granted the waiver of the 10-day statutory deadline. And that is a substantive issue because, as both courts held, it goes to the merits of the case. I did just want to respond to Mr. Matthews' claim that the state's objection was disingenuous. I mean, it seems here like the state can't win. I think the state here had clean hands. And they objected, whether it was a vigorous objection or whether it was a meek objection, it doesn't matter. They objected on the record. I also don't think that it's the record shows that the state would have been forced to join the motion to adjourn, because they could have started the probable cause hearing, as Justice Ballot pointed out. I mean, part of the thing in the probable cause hearing is you do, you know, introduce documents. The state could have started the probable cause hearing and started introducing the defendant's conviction. I also wanted to briefly discuss his claim that the trial court lost competency in this case. And under 801.582, the trial court would only lose competency in this case if it first held that the substitution request was untimely. And in this case, both the trial court and the chief judge did not find that the substitution request was untimely. So therefore the state did not lose competency through this case. Briefly to discuss Pure Milk, I know it's in the reply brief that Mr. Matthews goes into detail that Pure Milk applies because in that case, there was evidence received and there was testimony taken at the hearing. In this case, obviously, there was no evidence or testimony received at the probable cause hearing. But this court rejected that argument in Sealing. That was the arguments that the Sealings made, was that the motion to compel was not a preliminary contested matter because no evidence was received and no testimony was received. And it specifically rejected. They said that is not the dispositive issue. So therefore, I don't think Pure Milk controls this court's decision.
And so if I just want to make sure I can summarize your position here. Your position is you would like us to hold, and feel free to frame this however you'd like, but I understand you would like us to hold that that if there has been no request for substitution 48 hours before the scheduling of a probable cause hearing. That violates, that is not a timely request under the statute. Is that how you would frame it? Or if not, how would you frame your request, what we would hold as a court?
I don't think, I was careful not to say that it determines whether a probable cause hearing is scheduled. Probable cause hearing occurred. And so what I would say is just file the plain language of the statute. Did he file his substitution request preceding the hearing of the probable cause hearing? And he didn't. It doesn't matter what was scheduled, it actually occurred, and he failed to. I mean, if he would have stopped in the clerk of courts and handed him the one-page substitution motion that he handed the clerk on September 29th, then we wouldn't be here. Then that would be timely. But he didn't do it, and he was required to do that preceding the hearing of the probable cause hearing.
And a probable cause hearing was held because they showed up in court and postponed it?
The probable cause, well, that's what happened only as a result of Matthew's actions. They were ready, the state was ready to proceed. Everyone, and Mr. Matthew showed up and said, I'm not ready, I need an adjournment. And then 2 weeks later, he filed his substitution request. So they didn't get to the probable cause issue only because of Matthew's actions.
Okay, so counsel, let's say it's a very busy day in one of our circuit courts, which happens often, and they scheduled a probable cause hearing, but it never gets held. No witnesses are called. Nothing happens because they get to 5 o'clock and they can't get to it. And the court adjourns it. So you just placed it on Mr. Matthews. I'm having a hard time here. And I understood Justice Hagedorn's question. Is it the fact that the hearing was scheduled? Is it the fact that they actually walk into court? What if they never even walk up? What if the court, sometimes the court just hands out dates even off the record? What if they started a jury trial and they hand off a date off the record for the cause hearing? So what's your trigger there for the time frame?
So if the parties don't show up to the probable cause hearing and it's never held, then there is no, you know, there's no contested matter. There's no preliminary contested matters. It's just similarly adjourned. So I think it matters is whether it's when it starts, the probable cause hearing started, and he was required under the plain language of the statute just to file the substitution before that.
So the case was called? Like, so they call the case? Let's say I'll juxtapose two different scenarios. One is the court started a jury trial. Off the record, they're handing out adjournments. It happens all the time in Milwaukee. They hand out their adjournments. They never were physically in front of the court in terms of the hearing. Is that, did it start there? Versus it's the end of the day, it's 4:30, and the court decides to call each case and have each party on the record in front of the court. Does that matter for when they file their substitution request?
I just think under the plain language and under either scenario, as long as it's filed, you know, 30 seconds before that probable cause hearing starts, then it is timely. But if it is not filed preceding the probable cause hearing, again, if you...
Okay, so it doesn't have to start. You're saying the hearing doesn't have to start. The hearing just has to be scheduled. Because in one of my scenarios, it never started.
No, it does have to start because that is when the, you know, that's when the contested matter happens, is that it's supposed to happen at a preliminary contested matter.
So if it's supposed to happen, which means scheduled, I mean, I just want to be clear on what you're actually asking us to rule.
So I'm asking the court to rule that he has to file his substitution request preceding the hearing. In this case, the hearing started, he had 15 days to file his substitution request. He didn't do it before the hearing started. And so therefore, it just under the plain language of that statute, it was untimely.
Attorney Schaefer, do you think that an adjournment can ever, arguing over an adjournment, that could ever be a preliminary contested matter?
Again, I don't think the court has to get there. I think that's what...
No, I think we might be, though, so I want to give you the opportunity to ask, to answer them.
Sure, I mean, I think in this case, it is because it was tethered basically to that 10-day extension deadline. And so as the Court of Appeals held, the motion to adjourn here in this case had implications on the merits of Mr. Matthews' case. So in this case, if there ever was a case where a motion to adjourn was a preliminary contested matter, the state contested, you know, it was on the record. And as a result, I mean, either way, it implicated the merits. Either he's going to go forward with prepared counsel at the next probable cause hearing, or he's going to go forward with probable cause hearing that day with unprepared counsel. So either way, I mean, if ever there was a case, I guess, to answer your question, that an adjournment was a preliminary contested matter, I think this is the case. Yep. That's all that the state has, unless there are further questions from this court.
Okay, thank you. Attorney Haskell, are you ready to proceed with rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Please do.
So I think that the state here is, again, blurring the lines between what happened at the hearing and what would have happened had there not been an adjournment in the case. And the state argues that the decision on the adjournment could have implicated the merits of the case. I mean, but that's only if we... ruling on the adjournment does not affect the merits of the case in any way. It implicates whether they're going to reschedule a hearing that implicates the merits of the case. The probable cause hearing is the only thing implicating the merits of the case in this
matter. What about the extension of the statutory deadlines that have to do with whether he remained incarcerated or not?
I don't think that that statute has any bearing on whether the court has heard anything that bears on the substance of the matter. I think that this is just another statutory deadline that they needed to waive. Is another procedural matter that was part of this. Whether to adjourn the case was a procedural matter, whether to waive that timeline was a procedural matter. The court still didn't get to anything that related to the merits of the case here. If the court had denied the adjournment request, it still would not have made any decision with a bearing on the merits of the case, or the bearing on the substantive issues of the case. It is only if they'd actually gone forward with something relating to probable cause that this is an issue. And in this case, I mean, the state is advancing this argument that a probable cause hearing occurred in this case on that first date. And I think reading the transcript makes plain that that was not a probable cause hearing. That was simply an adjourned hearing. And the court actually has to have a probable cause hearing before it can be said to have addressed the merits of the matter. You know, the state also discussed this possibility of, you know, multiple adjournments. I mean, in response to a question posed by Justice Dallet, whether there could be just multiple adjournments on the record or off the record. I mean, there is still a 60-day deadline in this entire thing. I mean, it couldn't go on forever that this kept getting adjourned anyway. There is a different timeliness requirement that Mr. Matthews would have needed to meet had there been some succession of adjournments in this case. But there wasn't anything like that. There was one opportunity for the court to hear on the record of what had occurred. I mean, I think that Justice Dallet's questions indicate the difficulty of applying this rule if simply scheduling a matter is all that it takes to be said to have heard a preliminary contested matter. We don't know when on that, in that scenario where the court did not in fact call the case on the record, what time of day did the defendant need to file it by? You know, at what point did that substitution request need to be filed if the court never hears it on the record? I mean, if the hearing is scheduled for 1:30 and the court just happens to only get to it by 4 o'clock, I mean, is 1:30 the deadline or is 4 o'clock the deadline to have actually filed something in writing seeking substitution? You know, in this case.
Counsel, if you would, just in a couple of sentences, summarize for us what you'd like us to hold as a court.
I think that this court need only adopt the holding from Seelan that the dispositive question is whether the hearing concerned the substantive matters in the case going to the merits of the issues in the case, and that a rescheduling, an adjournment of a hearing, does not meet that test, because there is no way that a decision on rescheduling a hearing is going to implicate the merits of the matter. Again, it is only the next question. It's only after that, once we start discussing probable cause, that we've gotten to the merits of the matter. Here it was only a rescheduling, which, I mean, again, is quintessentially a procedural matter. If the court has any further questions, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I'll rest.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. It was a very good argument, and your briefs were quite helpful. Again, an interesting issue on substitution. So we are going to conclude this hearing, and everyone can get rearranged for our second oral argument of the morning. We are adjourned.